Other bogus inventors of the day included Gaston Bulmar, who tried to sell General Electric, GE, special pills that turned water into gasoline. Walter Hohenhau, who derived free energy from an H2O hydro atomizer. And King Kong, Victor the Count Lustig, who was eventually arrested for devising and selling a special money machine that cranked out crisp $20 bills from inserted white paper. In an age of new marvels that almost daily transformed society in irreversible ways, the public was ripe for picking. Naive investors were often bilked by promises of impossible schemes. Thus, the inventor was perceived in contradictory ways, as an executioner or light-bearer, con man or wizard. When Tesla returned from Europe, he wanted nothing better than to have his AC invention placed in the hands of its new rightful owner so that he could proceed with other burgeoning interests. Naturally, he would continue to aid Westinghouse in any way that he could, by continually offering advice to Scott, Schmidt, or Lamb, or stopping by at Pittsburgh to provide hands-on expertise. Throughout the 1890s, whenever the opportunity presented itself, Tesla would also introduce eminent prospective clients to the Westinghouse concern. As was his custom and style, Tesla never considered a commission for this service, although he did obtain vital equipment for his laboratory, which at first was provided without cost. And, as with Keeley, Bulwer Lytton's electrical-like energy called frill power had also been attached to Tesla by this time as well, via a letter from a lady in 1890 who dreamed that if I, Tesla, would read The Coming Race of Bulwer, I would discover great things which would advance my work considerably. But Tesla would not pursue the mystical treatise for a decade, and therefore it appears that although the inventions discussed in the story bore great similarities to some of Tesla's later creations, the reader must not say afterward that the beautiful things which I shall invent were suggested by Bulwer. Nevertheless, the similarities remain, and one wonders whether or not Tesla actually read the book at the time or knew of its contents. 8. South Fifth Avenue, 1890-91. At one bound, Tesla placed himself abreast such men as Edison, Brush, Elihu Thompson, and Alexander Graham Bell. His performance touched on the marvelous. Joseph Wetzler, in Harper's Weekly, July 11, 1891. Tesla returned from Paris during the summer of 1889 to his new laboratory near Bleecker Street. Down the road from one of Edison's showrooms, the lab took up the entire fourth floor of a six-story building located at 33-35 South Fifth Avenue, which today is called West Broadway. At the same time, he toured the hotels, moving into the Astor House, a posh five-story establishment situated by a trolley line in the heart of the city. Over the summer, Tesla's best friend, Anthony Seghetti, passed away. He wrote home to notify his family. "I feel alienated," he told Uncle Payo, "and it is difficult for me to adapt to the American lifestyle." Now part of the nouveau riche and also the star of the family, the inventor began sending money home to his mother and sisters, and also to some of the cousins. Addressing the letters mostly to his sisters' husbands, all of whom were priests, Tesla wrote Uncle Payo, "Somehow it is hard to correspond with the ladies." Although occasionally he did write his sisters, mostly he just sent checks, and each of them would repeatedly write back to try and get a more personal word from the only brother that we have. Throughout the 1890s, Tesla sent several thousand forints at 150 forints a clip, which was an amount equivalent to 6 months' rent at a well-to-do home or 6 months' salary for a Serbian workman. Some of the funds were given as gifts, some to pay back his uncles for their aid in funding his education and sojourn to the New World, and other funds, which were partially obtained through European royalties, were used as investments. To Uncle Peter, who had advanced to become a metropolitan cardinal in Bosnia, Tesla revealed that he was receiving many letters from dignitaries, and also such respect that it was difficult for him to describe. Uncle Payo occasionally shipped European bottles of wine to his finicky nephew, unhappy with the selection in the United States. Impatiently waiting for these bottles was, for Tesla, like waiting for the Messiah. As Tesla's fame grew, and reports of his successes made the headlines in their local papers, Tesla became a virtual demigod to the Serbian and Croatian people, and a noble, though distant, benefactor to his family. "We think about you even in our dreams," one of his brothers-in-law wrote. Except for occasional dinners with such friends as T.C. Martin or necessary trips to Pittsburgh, the inventor spent virtually all of his waking existence at the lab. His partner, Alfred S. Brown, would stop by to help when needed, but mostly Tesla worked with either one or two assistants or alone. As was his custom, he could labor 7 days a week and around the clock, stopping only to freshen up at the hotel or for a necessary appointment. Monastic by choice and compelled by an all-consuming desire to be a major player in the burgeoning new age, the wizard preferred working through the night when distractions could be minimized and concentration could be intensified. Now free, he began his investigations along a number of separate but interrelated lines. As an experimental physicist, he began to study the difference between electromagnetic and electrostatic phenomena, and also the relationship of the structure of the ether to that of electricity, matter, and light. As an inventor, he began to design equipment for generating extremely high frequencies and voltages, and for transforming direct into alternating current or vice versa, and for creating uniform oscillations. Tesla also wanted to devise ways to manufacture light and to explore the concept of wireless communication. Already concerned about the fragility of the Earth's natural resources, the finite supply of timber and coal, Tesla spent endless hours in contemplation reviewing and replicating the findings of others, criticizing or improving upon their inventions, and also designing completely original creations. His goal was influenced by an evolutionary perspective and pragmatic considerations. He wanted to devise mechanical means for doing away with needless tasks of physical labor so that humans could spend more time in creative endeavors. Unlike Karl Marx, who saw the worker becoming an appendage of the machine, Tesla realized that machines could liberate the worker. The inventor, in Tesla's eyes, had always been and always would be the light giver of the species, guiding its future through advanced technology. The masses, in turn, would benefit because machines would perform menial tasks so that they could pursue more intellectual occupations. With increased technology, cultural evolution would proceed at even faster rates. Conversely, Tesla warned, everything that is against the teachings of religion and law of hygiene tends to decrease human energy. Impure drinking water in particular was one of the greatest dangers. Within the next 18 months, Tesla initiated most of the inventions that would occupy him for the next half century. During the last weeks of 1889, Martin met with him on several occasions in order to finalize his article on the Serbs' heritage and plans for the future. The inventor would talk late into the night about his youth and the incessant struggle of his ancestors to fight off the diabolical Turks. As Martin took notes, Tesla outlined some of his inventions, particularly his work with high frequencies and his original theories on the relationship between electromagneticism and the structure of light. Martin tried to talk the inventor into presenting his ideas before the AIEE, but Tesla evaded a direct response. "Suppose I were to obtain for you Lord Kelvin's lectures. I know they're a bit wearisome and somewhat beyond solution, but I believe that you, Samson-like, can wrestle the honey from this lion's jaw." "Perhaps," was Tesla's reply. On January the 21st, 1890, Professor Anthony took over the presidency of the AIEE from Elihu Thompson, who followed T.C. Martin, and opened the year with his own lecture on new electrical theories. Happy to see the professor again, Tesla attended the seminar and was elected vice president. Participating in the discussion which followed, he was joined by Irish mathematician Arthur Kennelly of the Edison Company and Mikhail Pupin, a physics teacher and fellow Serb. Having just returned from Helmholtz's laboratory in Germany, Pupin was unaware of the extent of the animosity that had existed between the Edison and Westinghouse camps. Pupin was from Idvor, a Serbian town north of Belgrade. His father had been a knyaz, or village leader, much like Tesla's father, but unlike Milutin Tesla, Mr. Pupin was an illiterate peasant and not part of the clerical aristocracy. Many of Pupin's relatives, like Tesla's, were war heroes who had fought off the Turks to protect the empire, and like Tesla, Pupin had avoided military service. Mikhail Pupin emigrated to the United States in 1874. After working at odd jobs, he entered Columbia College in New York in 1878. Graduating in 1884 with a keen interest in electrical theory and with honors, Pupin received a fellowship to study abroad. He wanted to go to Cambridge to learn under James Clerk Maxwell, but he found upon his arrival that Maxwell had been dead for 4 years. This tendency to overlook the obvious appears to be a theme that runs through Pupin's life. After Cambridge, he went on to the University of Berlin, where he received a doctorate in physics. In 1889, he returned to New York to become an instructor at Columbia College. In February 1890, the full-page Martin article on Tesla was published in Electrical World, accompanied by a very prominent photograph of the youthful-looking engineer. For Tesla, it was excellent publicity, the first major essay to appear portraying the up-and-coming inventor. A meeting of the AIEE devoted entirely to the new Tesla AC system was planned for the following month. In particular, the conference had been sparked by a number of important developments. Most notably, plans coming from Switzerland and Germany for a proposed long-distance AC power transmission experiment, the impending success of the Westinghouse Company in instituting a hydroelectric plant utilizing the Tesla AC system at a mining camp in Telluride, Colorado, and the announcement of an international Niagara Commission to look into the best ways to harness Niagara Falls. At the March AIEE meeting, Professor Louis Duncan was the main speaker. His lecture began with a mathematical dissection of the workings of the novel and admirable little machine invented by Mr. Tesla. A former officer from the U.S. Naval Academy, Duncan had recently transferred from the South Pacific to Johns Hopkins University, where he stayed on to teach. An important ally, he gave the Tesla invention academic credibility. "The great advantage of the motor," Duncan said, "lies in the fact that it has no commutator, and it permits the use of very high voltages. In the future, power will be transmitted electrically at voltages that will make machines with the commutator next to useless." After the lecture, there was a discussion, and Tesla participated. Pupin, who spoke that summer in Boston and again in New York the following year on alternating current theory, was fast becoming an admirer of Tesla's work. However, at the same time, Pupin was also becoming embroiled in the controversy as to who was the real author of the AC polyphase system, and from Tesla's vantage point, Pupin made the mistake of befriending the wrong people. At the Boston meeting, Pupin noticed that my audience was divided into two distinct groups. One group was cordial and appreciative, but the other was as cold as ice. The famous electrical engineer and inventor Elihu Thompson was in the friendly group, and he looked me up after the address and congratulated me cordially. That was a great encouragement, and I felt happy. Other prominent individuals, however, tried to have Pupin fired from the electrical engineering department at Columbia because of his adherence to AC. But Pupin overrode the controversy and at the same time increased his friendship with Thompson. Unbeknown to Pupin, Thompson himself was in a quandary because he now recognized the clear advantage of the Tesla system, but he was locked out of its use because Westinghouse owned the patents. Although the Thompson-Houston Electric Company was extremely profitable, the concern faced certain doom if it was unable to use efficient AC machinery. As Elihu Thompson had worked with AC for over a decade, he felt fully justified in adapting a Tesla-like system, especially because there were other engineers who also claimed legitimate priorities of aspects of the system, notably Schallenberger and Ferraris. Furthermore, Thompson himself had come close to conceiving a similar workable plan. That Tesla held fundamental patents on a completely revolutionary invention was continually overlooked by Thompson as he sought ways to rationalize his position while working at his company, presiding at the AIEE, and writing in the electrical journals. He had successfully circumvented the Edison light bulb patents by paying Sawyer for a license to produce the stopper lamp, an exhausted light bulb similar to Edison's, which used a rubber plug, stopper, to hold in the vacuum. and so he sought a similar tack with AC. During a heated series of articles in Electrical World between Thomson and Tesla, it appears that Thomson admits to some of his distaste for his rival when he writes, "I confess that my statement as to the motive of my critical remarks may have been out of place. They were elicited, however, by Mr. Tesla having on a former occasion misunderstood my motives." And so Pupin's feelings for his Serbian brother became undermined as his friendship with Thomson grew. Tesla agreed to present his work in high-frequency phenomena during a 3-day symposium of the AIEE, which was held in May 1891, 3 months after he first published his research on the topic. A hall was booked at the Columbia College, which at the time was located between Park and Madison Avenues on 49th and 50th Streets, and the public was invited. It is difficult to calculate the enormous impact that this lecture had on the engineers of the day and on the course of Tesla's life, for it is clear that after the event, Tesla was perceived in an extraordinary way. Joseph Wentzler, or Josh, as he preferred to be called, covered the talk for Electrical World. But Tesla's lecture was too important for a single exposure in a journal of limited circulation, and Wentzler was able to also peddle the piece as a spectacular full-page account in the prestigious Harper's Weekly. "With lucid explanations in pure nervous English," Wentzler proclaimed, "this stripling from the dim borderland of Austro-Hungary had not only gone far beyond the two distinguished European scientists, Dr. Lodge and Professor Hertz, in grasp of electromagnetic theory of light, but he had actually made apparatus by which electrostatic waves or thrusts would give light for ordinary everyday uses." Tesla had not only presented a remarkable display of electrical phantasmagoria, he had also outlined new fundamental and far-reaching principles. Wentzler cogently pointed out that Tesla had gone far beyond Heinrich Geissler and Sir William Crookes in the production of light by use of vacuum tubes, and he had also eclipsed the Wizard of Menlo Park with his refinements of the incandescent lamp. But Mr. Tesla was not satisfied with these results, brilliant as they were. He had set himself no less a task than to create a lamp which, without any external connection to wires, would glow brightly when placed anywhere in an apartment. And if that were not enough, for a conclusion, Tesla passed tens of thousands of volts of AC through his body to light up light bulbs and shoot sparks off his fingertips and to show the world that it was not at all a killer current when utilized correctly. "Exhausted tubes held in the hand of Mr. Tesla appeared like a luminous sword in the hand of an archangel representing justice," said one reporter. With Gano Dunn, his assistant, Tesla began his talk somewhat nervously, but gained momentum as he progressed. "Of all the forms of nature's immeasurable, all-pervading energy, which ever and ever change and move like a soul animates an innate universe, electricity and magnetism are perhaps the most fascinating. We know," Tesla continued, "that electricity acts like an incompressible fluid, that there must be a constant quantity of it in nature, that it can neither be produced or destroyed, and that electric and ether phenomena are identical. Having set up the premise that our world is immersed in a great sea of electricity, the wizard proceeded to astound the audience with his myriad experiments." And at the end, Tesla's matched his opening in poetic expression. "We are whirling through endless space with an inconceivable speed," he said. "All around us everything is spinning, everything is moving, everywhere is energy." Based on this premise, Tesla ended with a prophetic supposition, which has often been interpreted by some to suggest that a zero point or free energy strata exists. "There must be some way of availing ourselves of this energy directly," he said. "Then, with the light obtained through the medium, with the power derived from it, with every form of energy obtained without effort from stores forever inexhaustible, humanity will advance with giant strides. The mere contemplation of these magnificent possibilities expands our minds, strengthens our hopes, and fills our hearts with supreme delight." Those who attended the lecture, including Professor Anthony, Alfred S. Brown, Elmer Sperry, William Stanley, Elihu Thompson, and Francis Upton, would remember the historic occasion for the rest of their lives. Robert Millikan, for instance, who later won a Nobel Prize for his work with cosmic rays, was a graduate student at Columbia at the time. He said many years later, "I have done no small fraction of my research work with the aid of the principles I learned that night." Mikhail Pupin, who also attended, however, appears not to have been so entranced. "While I was lecturing," Tesla told a Serbian reporter, "Mr. Pupin, with his friends, most likely Elihu Thompson and Carl Haring, interrupted by whistling, and I had difficulty quieting down the misled audience." Pupin wrote to Tesla to smooth things over and to set up an appointment to see the motor, as he was scheduled to deliver a number of lectures on polyphase currents, but Tesla avoided him. In Europe, rumors began to circulate about the new electrical Svengali in America, and Tesla was quickly invited to speak before European scientific societies. 9. Revising the Past, 1891. Many of the investigations of the book apply to polyphase system circuits, with chapters on induction motors, generators, synchronous motors, etc. A part of this book is original. Other parts have been published before by other investigators. I have, however, omitted altogether literary references for the reason that incomplete references would be worse than some, while complete references would entail expenditure of much more time than is at my disposal. I believe that the reader is more interested in the information than in knowing who first investigated the phenomenon. Charles Steinmetz. 3 months after Tesla's Columbia College lecture in August 1891, two engineers, Charles Eugene Lancelot Brown of the Swiss firm of Maschinenfabrik Oerlikon and Michael von Dolliver Dobrowolski, representing the German firm Allgemeine Elektrizitätsgesellschaft, AEG, galvanized the engineering community when they successfully transmitted 190 horsepower from a waterfall at a cement factory on the Neckar River in Laufen to the International Electrical Exposition, which was being held at Frankfurt, Germany, 112 miles away. With the support of three different governments, the lines passed through Württemberg, Bavaria, and Prussia before arriving in Frankfurt. By using oil as an insulator, as Tesla had explained in his Columbia College lecture, Brown was able to generate as much as 40,000 volts on his equipment, 25,000 of which he transported along the wires, stepping them down to usable frequencies when they reached the exposition. The efficiency of 74.5% astounded his colleagues. Dobrowolski, who suggested that the invention was his conceptualization, utilized a three-phase AC with a working frequency of 40 cycles per second, instead of the single-phase current with a frequency of 133 cycles per second that the Westinghouse people kept insisting on. The power was so great at the Frankfurt site that a large advertising sign with 1,000 incandescent lamps was lit, and a motor pump powering an artificial waterfall was harnessed. On December the 16th, Mikhail Pupin delivered a talk before the AIEE on polyphase systems. Having given the same talk a week before at the New York Mathematical Society, Pupin was proud to advance abstract theories on this new field of polyphase systems. With his hair swept back, wearing wire-rimmed glasses, a brush moustache tapered at the ends, and a professorial three-piece suit, Pupin was fast readjusting to his return to the States. Now he was beginning to carve a name for himself. Dutifully, he had written Tesla before the talk to discuss his motors, but the inventor had eluded him. In his opening remarks at the AIEE, with Arthur Kennelly, Elihu Thompson, Charles Bradley, and Charles Steinmetz present, Pupin referred to the beautiful inventions of Nikola Tesla and the completeness of the success which Dobrowolski and Brown obtained by the practical applications of these inventions. But he also described the German operation in such a way as to imply that aspects of it were independently conceived. It appears that Tesla did not attend the lecture. Instead, he wrote Pupin the day after, but it was not to offer congratulations or to extend an invitation to meet. Tesla suggested that Pupin obtain the original patent specifications. The German design was simply a copy of his work. But Pupin shot back. I don't think that you ought to find fault with me for not having given your invention a fuller discussion. In the first place, it was a little bit too soon to discuss the practical details in a paper which treats of the most general fundamental principles of the polyphasal systems. Secondly, I know of your motors only by hearsay. I have not had the pleasure of being shown one by anybody. I looked you up twice at your hotel and wrote you once, but all my efforts were in vain. Pupin tried at the end of the letter to set up a personal interview, but Tesla was not one who could easily forgive such naivety, especially from a Serb who spoke the native tongue so poorly. To the hypersensitive Tesla, Pupin was a man who spread falsehoods, and his continual association with Thompson did not help. As Tesla was about to take a trip to Europe, a meeting of amelioration never took place. Concerning the dispute over whose invention it really was, it's important to realize that obfuscation of the truth continues to this day. The problem began with Michael von Dolever Dobrovolsky himself, who was reluctant to admit that he got the idea from Tesla, and it was perpetuated by his friend Karl Hering, who wrote a prodigious number of articles on the episode in the journals as the event unfolded throughout 1891. Hering had been a professor of engineering at the university in Darmstadt, Germany, in the early 1880s. His protégé, Dobrovolsky, a native of St. Petersburg and the son of a Russian nobleman, replaced Hering when he retired from the university at the end of 1883. C.E.L. Brown, a Swiss native and son of a designer of steam engines, began successfully transmitting electrical power with AC dynamos he had constructed while working in Lucerne. Brown, who was a year younger than Dobrovolsky and 7 years younger than Tesla, had received most of his training in Winterthur and Basel, where he worked for the Burgin machine shops. In 1884, he began his employment at Uhrleichen, and within 2 years became director of operations. On February the 9th, 1891, Brown delivered an address in Frankfurt on the subject of long-distance transmission of electrical power, and that is where he met Dobrovolsky. A partnership was formed between Uhrleichen and AEG, and within 7 months, their success between Laufen and Frankfurt was achieved. Now, with Dobrovolsky's claims and Hering's one side reporting in the electrical journals, factions of the American engineering community that were locked out of the Tesla patents could extol the Laufen-Frankfurt venture while at the same time continuing to imply that Tesla's work was not intrinsic to its success. Ironically, the Westinghouse side wanted to downplay the event as well, not only because it proved Tesla right and them wrong, but also because it dwarfed their success at Telluride. Thus, when perusing the Westinghouse literature, one is hard-pressed to find any mention of Laufen-Frankfurt at all. Pupin and his lectures did not support Tesla's role, nor did Kennelly, Thompson, or Bradley. Charles Proteus Steinmetz, however, was in another category. Like Pupin, he had just emigrated from Europe, and also like Pupin, he was academically oriented, with no particular economic stake in the invention at that time. Steinmetz, who had fled Germany in 1889 in order to escape imprisonment for being a revolutionary socialist, was a brilliant student of mathematics from the University of Breslau. A dwarf hunchback, with his head sunk into his shoulders and one leg shorter than the other, Steinmetz had to continually overcome his odd appearance and frail disposition by displaying an advanced intellect. Just 26 years old, and still attempting to cultivate a moustache and beard, Steinmetz, who was gaining a reputation for his work on the law of hysteresis, which involved a mathematical explanation that explained the lagging of magnetic effects when electromagnetic forces are changed, recognized some flaws in Pupin's talk. As this would be one of his earliest attempts to express himself before his peers in the difficult English language, he carefully bolstered the addendum by bringing along calculations and drawings. Working in Yonkers, Steinmetz had developed a single-phase commutator motor a year before in the summer of 1890. With brazenly long shoulder-length hair, the gnome was dressed in a slightly wrinkled three-piece suit adorned with an opulent watch chain and a pair of pince-nez that hung distinctively from a strap attached to his right collar. Standing to his full height of 4 feet,